This is one of our favorite outdoor explorers and has been edited to be replayed here today.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. My guest today is Bill Hess. Bill is someone I've wanted to sit down with for a long time, and I'm really happy with the opportunity to do it on the show and share it with you. I first became aware of his work when I was writing about the whaling culture of the Inupiat on Alaska's Arctic coast. Bill had already been there and had documented that culture and the lifeways of the community better than anyone else. His photography and writing in the book Gift of Whale make it an important classic of Alaska literature that, in my opinion, has never been equaled. The reason for that is the intimacy that Bill created with his subjects. He was treated as a member of the Native community, not as an outsider. That's been his way through a long career as a photojournalist, and it makes his work exceptionally powerful in the many settings where he has worked. I've had a chance to see some of his current work as well, and it is extraordinary. So for today's show, I've welcomed Bill Hess in the studio to talk about his life and work, many adventures in the Alaska outdoors, and of course his photography and what we can learn from it as amateur photographers. Thanks for being with us, Bill.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I remember going up to Barrow and spending time in the whaling camp and talking to people, and everybody knew your name, and everybody talked about, well, just talk to Bill Hess, or just ask Bill Hess, or get photos from Bill Hess. And in fact, my book, The Whale and the Supercomputer, we used one of your photos on the cover because such a poetic, beautiful photo of the Umiak waiting to launch off the ice. And I guess I'm interested in how you... you had a dream of going to the Arctic, right? That was like something you always wanted to do.
That is correct. From the time I was a child.
Yeah. Where did that come from?
Hard to say, but I would say from two things. One, when I was very small, we lived in Pendleton, Oregon, and one night my dad called me out to the front porch, and there was a very rare southerly display of northern lights. And they were red. They were not green like they often are around here with red and stuff tinged. They were just red. And the sky throbbed, and it was so mysterious. And so awe filled me with such awe. And then later, my dad, he loved the poetry of Robert Service. And later, he quoted a poem. There are strange things done under the midnight sun. The northern lights. The next words loses me, but he had it. But you get the idea.
Yeah.
And I just kind of got this awesome feeling about the far north and wanted to go there. But of course, you're young and other things happen.
But you followed through with it where not many, many people get that yen, but they sort of get sidetracked. But you ended up really devoting your life to photographing the North, or a large part of it.
Yes.
So how did you get into that community? You know, when I was working on my book, I found it challenging because, let's face it, a lot of journalists have written unfairly and negatively about Eskimos and about the Arctic community, and people there are very gun-shy of talking to journalists, or they're almost... They have sort of certain people, oh, you could talk to this person, that person sort of knows how to deal with reporters. Getting inside the community and getting welcomed in, you have to build some trust. I don't know anybody who's built trust the way you did. So how did you enter? How did you make your entree up there?
Well, after I got to Alaska, I got a job after a while with the Tundra Times.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which, no, does that still exist?
No, it does not.
Yeah, it was sort of a rural newspaper.
It was a rural native newspaper.
Yeah.
It was founded by an Inupiat, so... Mm-hmm.
And that you just saw that job was available and you applied for it?
Not exactly.
Okay, tell a story. Let's hear it.
I just knew I wanted to come to Alaska when my wife and I got married. Our understanding was we were coming to Alaska. Uh-huh. But she is Apache, White Mountain. And late one summer, our first summer that we were married, we went down to visit her family on the reservation. And while we were there, a woman was killed in a car crash. So we went to her wake. And when we got there, they have their wakes. They have the casket in the house. The lid is open. and people pay their respects, they eat, they sing, and what have you. And the tribal chairman was there. He was standing right alongside me when I was viewing this woman I did not know, but who was tied into my family. Mm-hmm. And he asked what I was studying, and I told him. And he said, oh, well, you will have to come down when you graduate and do the tribal paper. And I told him, no, I'm going to Alaska.
Yeah.
And then my wife and I returned to BYU, where we were students at the time. And 3 weeks later, her father was killed in an accident.
Oh, my gosh.
Almost identical and almost in the very same place.
Wow.
And we returned to the reservation for his funeral. And we needed to line up some speakers, and we went into, he had been real good friends with the tribal chairman. They had run fence together on the reservation line for many years and done other things. So we went in and asked the tribal chairman if he would speak. And he said, yes. And he said, this job is waiting for you. He said, you have roots here. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, but we're going to Alaska.
Uh-huh.
Well, when we got back, and my wife was pregnant at the time, and, you know, the thought just kept coming to my head. And I thought, you know, I am married to a White Mountain Apache. I need to know something more than what I have seen so far about what that means.
What is her world? What's her culture? Where
that
she's
is from? Correct.
Yeah.
And I thought, how better to learn than to do the tribal paper? So I took the job. And, you know, they called it the job of editor. But really, it was the job of staff. I had a few people help me with this and that now and then. And I hired a Navajo, the most brilliant cartoonist and person I'd ever met for a while, but I did all the reporting, I did all the photography, I developed all the film, I laid the paper out, I drove 200 miles to take it to press, 200 miles back, and I typically would put in 24, 30 or more hour days and then crash for a bit and do it all over again.
You know, there's something about working for a small town paper. And I had the same experience when I was starting out with the Homer News. Not like that. I mean, there was a 3 or 4 member staff, but you ended up doing everything. You didn't take the picture, write the caption, assign the story, write the story, lay out the story, write the headline. And therefore you learn the whole thing and you learn how to interact with people in a fair and honest way, because you know you're going to run into them the next day, right?
Right, right. And so to shorten the story, my paper traded newspapers with virtually every American Indian newspaper in the country. Uh-huh. And that included the Tundra Times.
I got you.
Founded by Howard Rock of Point Hope.
Mm-hmm.
And of all the papers we got, that was the one I was most interested in.
Right.
And so I would look at it, I would read it, and, you know, but I witnessed the death of Howard Rock through that paper, and a lot of things, heard about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or learned a bit about mm-hmm. it, this and that. And, of course, Alaska was always on my mind.
So what year did you actually get here?
1981.
And so you went to work for the Tundra Times pretty quick after that?
2 months.
And then that was your opportunity to really see the state and really meet the people.
That is correct.
So I guess if you come from the Tundra Times, then you're going to be welcomed in the community because people know that it's their newspaper. True?
That is true. And it's not totally true, but it was largely true. They still want to know about you as an individual.
Uh-huh.
But it's an entree.
Yeah. So. Well, tell me about covering those Native communities, because it's a tricky process, right? And here's one thing that I've observed. If you go in there and you just start asking questions People are going to tell you more than they should be telling you, because people in rural Alaska are very open, and if they see you as a human being, they're going to tell you stuff that they probably wouldn't even tell you if they're a friend in the white community. Certainly in the white community, they would never tell you that if you knew they knew you were a journalist. So then if you are sort of an outside journalist and don't know the culture, you're going to go write about that, and they're going to be embarrassed, and their community is going to be embarrassed because you didn't know what really the boundary line was, right? So you got to go into the community with a filter, thinking about what should this person be telling me out of what they are telling me. Do you have the same experience? Like, it's almost like you can't write down everything people tell you because it's not going to come out the way that it should.
Well, I've never thought of it quite like that. That's a hard one for me to answer. I mean,
well, somehow you built this trust where people saw your work, and that you, next time they came back, they talked to you again.
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of things that help a lot. One was my background, not only with my wife's people, but with the Lakota before that. And two is the fact that very early in my life, I learned when you go into someone's house and they offer you food or they have food on the table, you eat it. Mm-hmm. You don't say, oh, I can't eat that.
Right.
You eat it, and you will find it is good. It is not for no reason that the people of a place wind up eating the food they eat. That is the food of the place. So wherever I go, I would eat whatever they had, and people appreciate that. Mm-hmm. They truly do. And odd as it may sound, I'm kind of a shy person, and that makes me a little less pushy sometimes than other people are. Mm-hmm. And that, I believe, has helped too.
I think that you're a shy person, and I would say you're a humble person. You don't go around bragging about your accomplishments, and that that they fit in a little bit better that way too.
Well, thank you. So, and then I guess, you know, traveling away out into the villages, it's you're away from your wife, you're away from your children, and it's lonely in that sense sometimes. But at the same time, I always loved being out there. I love being with the people. I love being in the country with the people. And I think they know that. And so...
Yeah, it was your dream, and your dream kind of came true.
Right, yeah. Right.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and I'm talking with Bill Hess today. Bill's a photographer and journalist who has covered Alaska for decades and has taken some of the most amazing pictures of subsistence lifestyle and the native people of Alaska. You know, he wrote the book Gift of the Whale, which is this extraordinary piece of photojournalism about the Inupiaq whaling tradition, and he's still taking pictures, and we're going to be putting a bunch of those on our website that you can check out at alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show. Bill Hess is my guest. So, Bill, tell me about your first experience or your most memorable experiences of whaling, because you got to see it in a way that almost nobody does who's an outsider. You got in the boat. You got to see every aspect of whaling.
My most memorable experience. Now, that is
so
a
many,
tough
right?
one.
Yeah. were you shocked when you first got out there and saw what an amazing thing it is for them to harvest these huge animals with this, you know, the skin boat and the age-old technology? I mean, to me, it's a very moving experience to see that.
Yes, I guess you could say shocked or amazed or, I mean, first I saw the environment before I saw the whale, the ice going out for miles and miles before you get to the open lead, the pressure ridges like miniature mountain ranges, temperatures cold, so cold at the end of April and early May that a lot of people who live in places with tough winters would be floored to be out there. And so my first thought was, my goodness, they have actually lived out here and done this for thousands of years. And how tough do you have to be how smart do you have to be to do that? So that was my first thought. I suppose my single most amazing experience would be there was a captain in Barrow, and the first crew I had followed was that of George Amawak, right after he became mayor, and I did that actually for We Alaskans.
Mm-hmm.
But once I started working up there and putting out a publication for the borough that was funded by the borough.
So you were there. You were their person, yeah.
By then, and yeah. I thought, well, okay, this will be a conflict. If I can go back to the mayor's crew, but I really should move out into the community.
Mm-hmm. And what year are we talking about?
I started this in 85, but my first whaling season doing, I had already been whaling out there for We Alaskans,
mm-hmm.
but my first whaling season for Unyik magazine was 86.
Okay.
And, you know, I didn't really know that many people, but I wanted to find a crew I could follow. And the quota was tight then. They were not able to land the number of whales they needed and wanted and are finally able to land. But when a whale was landed, I would go out. And towards the end, a fellow by the name of Kunuk, Jonathan Aiken, he landed the whale. It wasn't a huge whale, probably about 40 feet. I can't remember, maybe a little less, maybe a little more. But he got on top of that whale, and he had his two little grandsons, and they tucked in with him. And I felt something special with this man and those grandsons. So I took some pictures and put them in Wunyuk. And, then, you know, superficial stuff, not really, but compared to what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it didn't include the hunt itself. It just included the captain and his grandsons atop the well.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is the crew I want to follow. And, you know, his son, Johnny Lee Aiken, we became pretty good friends pretty quick. And he says, well, I'll ask my dad, because it had to come from his father.
And you were living in the community, so you had the time to build this relationship.
Yes, I was going back and forth, because when we got to Alaska, my wife said, I will not live north of Fairbanks. I took her to Fairbanks in the winter when it was minus 45. Oops. In the middle of the day. She says, I won't live in Fairbanks.
Bad choice, yeah.
Yeah, so we had to reach a compromise. Mm-hmm. She had given up her White Mountain Apache Arizona homeland to come to Alaska with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I compromised, but I would spend weeks, even months away.
Yeah, tough.
Yeah, that could get really
tough.
So
the Aikens invited you into their crew.
Yeah, well, what happened is a year passed, and I hadn't heard. And it was whaling season starting again. And just before they go out, they give away candy. So they were heard they were giving away candy. So very sad and dejected because I didn't have a crew to follow. I went over to their house where they were getting ready to go, and they were giving out candy. And Kunuk looked at me, crew cut on his head, sunglasses on his eyes, white parka, all ready to go. And he looked at me and he said, you coming?
You bet I am, right?
Yeah. And so I guess my very favorite memory would be 3 years later, because as I say, the quota was tight then. You could go out and spend the whole season on the ice and never get a whale, because you got a few whales, you had to stop.
Right.
The whole community had to stop, pack up and go in.
And the quota set by the International Whaling Commission, because they were concerned about the whale numbers. That's a whole different story, but
yeah.
The whale numbers were okay and they're growing now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But my basic point is I had followed him out there for 3 years and had never seen a whale taken or landed. I had seen him landed, pulled up onto the ice when other crews got him and would go over.
You need help, yeah.
Right. And I had, you know, I had always gotten, you would be out there for all, you know, you could stay out there for days to weeks at a time. And I would get, you would sit on the upturned sled up, you know, on ice blocks, and that would be your bench. You would have a windbreak. And I always made it a point that my first round sitting out there, I would go 24 hours. I would, because, you know, a lot of whalers would do that. They would sit there for 24 hours.
You're just looking for a whale.
Just looking for a whale. And so that's what I did. I would sit there for 24 hours. I would not leave. And sometimes I got very cold, especially before I really learned how to dress, and especially before I got an Inuvik parka. Mm-hmm. I would get really cold. And so on the third year, plus you have to work as you're going out. You have to cut trail with pickaxe.
Hard work.
Yeah. You have to do all kinds of things, and you work up a sweat.
Mm-hmm.
And you take your parka off and this and that, but you still work up a sweat. And I was not as well equipped or as smart to handle it as they were.
Yeah.
So I would get really, really cold. I would never say a word. I would not complain. Nobody ever heard a complaint about being cold out of me. But on the third year, I thought, okay, I am not going to freeze this year. And so I had a change of clothes all ready to go to put under my parka and pants.
Uh-huh.
And it was funny ice that year compared to other years in that there was good thick ice closer to shore, but then some what they call young new ice had come in and it had crunched and broken, and it took a long time for Kunuk to find a suitable place to make a camp. But he found it, and then we had to work pretty hard to get out there to cut down all these up paths,
For listeners who don't know, you're essentially building a road out there that you can haul big sleds with snow machines out there.
And the boat.
And then bring everything back after you catch the whale. So you're essentially building a road through these mountains of ice.
Right.
Yeah.
And so when we got to camp and they set camp out, I was soaked under my parka. And they got the tent put up and I said, okay, I'm going to go in and I'm going to change my clothes into dry clothes. And then I'm going to go out there and sit for 24 hours and I am not going to get as cold as I have gotten in the past. So I go in the tent and I take my parka off and I take my lighter jacket off and stuff underneath. And I think, what if a whale comes while I am doing this? And I thought, no. I have set out there for 3 years, and no whale has come to us. And that's what the Inupiaq believe. The whale comes to you.
It's a gift, right.
Right. And so I can take the time to change into dry clothes. So I took my shirts off. I took my boots off, but I very carefully placed them by the tent flap so I could get into them again quick. Took my overpants off. I'm down to like just skivvies on top, and I'm starting to take my Levi's off because I had Levi's underneath it.
Uh-huh.
And Johnny Lee says, "Well," and I thought, "Oh no!" And I just made sure I had my pants on and got my boots on. And I had two cameras, one with a wide-angle lens, one with a zoom telephoto, and I grabbed, they were sitting right by the tent flap as well, and I grabbed them. I go out the tent, and I'm staying low, because I don't know where that whale is, and I don't want to be the one who scares it away.
Yeah, people don't know that. You got to be camouflaged, you got to be still, you got to be quiet.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And to my great amazement, when I get out there, the Umiak is sitting there at the edge of the water. The crew members are all hunched down around the edge of it, hiding themselves from the well, and I can see the well, and it is right in front of the boat, and Kunuk is picking up his harpoon, and Eli is getting ready with the shoulder gun, and I lift my camera to my eye, and my breath has hit the view finder, and it is completely fogged up. I cannot see anything but haze, but I have to take pictures. And so I'm not in quite the right spot to actually get it, but so I move just a few feet to the side and shoot, no motor drive, just a thumb.
Mm-hmm.
And so I shoot as fast as I can as he throws the harpoon. And I don't know if I'm in focus. I don't know if I'm out of focus. And Eli follows up with the shoulder gun and then shoots the bomb. And then there's quiet. Just everybody is quiet. The well disappears. And everybody's quiet and sitting there. Standing there, actually. And then you hear the boom, boom. The bombs go off beneath the water.
Oh, my gosh.
We wait a little bit, and then the whale rises to the surface, and it rolls to its side, and it lifts a flipper into the air. And when that happens, that whale has given itself to you. That whale is yours. So it was an instant kill. It died right there on the edge of the ice. And I guess, in part because it was the first well I saw landed, in part because it looked and felt and seemed to confirm what anyone outside of the culture would think is just a wild story about the well giving itself, that was just amazing to me.
Oh, wow. So, what a story, Bill. I'm with Bill Hess. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Bill is a photographer who has documented Alaska Native culture like no one else has ever done over the last 30 years. He's going to be with me for the second half of the show, so please stick with us as we continue with Outdoor Explorer. We're going to take a break now. The Anchorage Museum recently wrapped up an exhibit with a German photographer who has worked in the Arctic. For him, getting the right shots involved getting intimate with the elements, like camping out for days at minus 30 degrees. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes has the story.
So what we see here is three bull musk oxen outside of Nome.
Florian Scholz takes photos of wild animals, but the animals aren't really the point so much as the spectacular terrains that they're a part of.
And I found these musk oxen at a time when there was a real blizzard going on, and it was these three musk ox bulls, and first we're actually butting heads a little bit. But when everything really came together was when the three muskox bulls all got in this perfect formation and headed towards the setting sun, and it was just a magical moment.
The German artist started taking photos at age 14, and they quickly evolved into a blend of art and social commentary.
So a lot of my work is really about capturing the essence of a place where I want to document entire ecosystems. So often I incorporate the animals in part of landscape.
That brought him to Alaska. When he was a 22-year-old exchange student, he drove up all the way along the Hall Road to the North Slope.
What has drawn me to Alaska really is the wildness, and that you still have ancient movements of animals like the great caribou migration, where animals in the tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands, move across a still wild landscape. And nowhere else in the world do you still find something like that.
Scholz's work brings him to other places too, but he has a particular drive to enliven what people see when they think of the Arctic. Instead of a static, blank expanse, he wants to expose the wildness that most of us are not patient or bold enough to seek out. To do it, he spends weeks and months on end camping in extreme locales, observing.
So it's a little bit of a selfish part of this too, because I want to immerse myself. I want to feel, I want to smell, I want to listen to the birds, and then, of course, capture those visual moments as well. And it's more than the animal itself, it's the whole atmosphere.
His work draws on familiar themes from the environmental conservation movement, but it never feels heavy-handed. Even a picture of a pair of calm-looking polar bears suspended on a lonely ice float isn't focused on their particular plight so much as showcasing the habitat evaporating all around them. The image isn't an admission of defeat, but it does pose a heavy question. How will these animals go on living here? Scholz's series of 36 photos is titled To the Arctic. It's his first solo exhibit at the Anchorage Museum. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. Find Outdoor Explorer anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store. We're also available online at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to one of our favorite outdoor explorers here on KSKA Anchorage. It has been edited to be replayed here today.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. My guest today is Bill Hess. He's a photographer who has documented Alaska Native culture, the whaling tradition of the North Slope, and traditions in many other places. He's the author of the classic book, Gift of the Whale, and really been enjoying his stories today about the time he spent whaling and working in Native communities. And Bill, you're also a pilot, and I know your dad was a military aviator in World War II, and that's a big part of your life. You fell in love with Alaska. You fell in love with aviation. During the 80s, when folks were leaving and the economy was down, you managed to get a really good deal on an airplane. And then that was really a big part of your life for a long time.
It was. That airplane and I were like a cowboy and his horse.
So was that a big part of your, I mean, that must have been a super important tool for you as a journalist.
It was. An airplane also opens doors because you can give people airplane rides. So, you know, yeah, I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
So you're not you're coming to this from being a freelance journalist or working for a small weekly newspaper, which is a very economically iffy proposition. It's hard to do. And people think of pilots as being, you know, a doctor or a lawyer has tons of money. How did you manage that?
Well, first, you got to think of a small bush plane, in my case, Citabria, which I was able to pick up for less than some used pickup trucks would cost.
You got very lucky there. Yeah.
Yes. And I was fortunate also in that it was, you could burn car gas in it. So I could go to a place where I could not get avgas, but I could get car gas. And it was always a challenge. I mean, it was always a challenge, and you know, sometimes good things would happen along the way, like the time I went to Point Lay, and there had been beluga or marine mammal biologists who come in ahead of me with a big airplane to do aerial beluga surveys, and they needed a lot of fuel, and they had a bunch of drums shipped in, and when they would fuel their plane, they could not get the last few gallons in the barrel with their pump, but they told me if I could get it, I could have it. And it really wasn't that hard to get. You just tip the barrel on its side and you got it, you know? So that was nice.
You were more motivated than they were. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was that. I mean, that only happened to me once, but it was real nice when it did. So
how did you figure out what you were going to take pictures of? I mean, were you usually on assignment? I know you did work for National Geographic and other big big publications. How did you figure out where you were going to shoot, and then you just fly your plane out and look for something to take a picture of? How did that work?
Well, I never had any particular formula, but and it happened however it happened. And as I say, I'm despite everything I have done, I remain pretty shy. It probably doesn't seem like it or sound like it now, but I do. So one example, I had, done some whale, covering whale hunting here and there, but I wanted to get the villages. And one village in particular was Wainwright. And I thought, okay, I had better call someone over there and see if I can get myself set up. But I could not make myself pick up the phone. I just couldn't do it. And finally, the day came when I knew it was now or never. And so I got up in the morning, I preheated my engine, started the plane up, got inside, let it warm up a bit. And I was terrified because I'm shy. I was terrified about going over there and not knowing what was going to happen, not knowing how I would be received. So, but I flew over, landed at the airport.
Flew all the way up from Anchorage to Wainwright?
No, from I was in Barrow.
Oh, you were in Barrow, got you.
I was in Barrow.
Short flight.
Yeah, 90-some miles. And so I just started walking the perimeter of the village, and I came upon a whaling crew who I would come to be very close to, but I hadn't become close to them yet. And I started chatting with the captain and saying, well, I left some pretty strong hints that I was kind of hoping to go whaling. And he left some pretty strong hints that he was not ready to take a white man onto his crew.
Who just showed up from nowhere, yeah.
Yeah, so I kept walking, and finally I got to the road leading back to the, I got almost to the road leading back to the airport. And I thought, dang, I do not want to get in that plane and go back empty-handed, but what do I do? But there was a house there on the bluff over the ocean, and there was a crew out there getting ready to go whaling. And I had earlier taken a picture of the captain with his two brothers standing on a gravel pit, and that had been my coverage of Wainwright for that year. But so I at least knew him, and he at least knew me, and so started talking to him, and pretty soon, you can come. And his daughter later told me that they were all shocked. Dad's bringing a white man with us. A tunic is the word. And that's how I got in with them. It turned out just to be a wonderful season, except for the fact I broke my tailbone. And they adopted me. They adopted me, and so that was Ben Amawak and his wife, Florence, and to this day, I mean, they're both passed on now, mm-hmm. but to this day, the children, they treat me as family, and I'm planning to go whaling with them again.
Do you feel like once they see your work and see that you... See, my feeling about your work, the listeners can see some of it if they go to our website, alaskapublic.org, and click on today's show about Bill Hess. So you'll see what I'm talking about if you're at the computer. But I mean, your work is very, there's emotion to it, which I don't know how you do that with a camera, but there's a feeling there of connection to the people you're taking a picture of, and the beauty and the composition of the work is all there. But there's also just this other element, very hard to express. And it would seem to me that if somebody took a picture of that of me and my culture and showed that, yeah, he really got it, then the next time I'd be very welcoming to him. I mean, is that part of the magic that you're doing here? Is it, yeah,
well,
they
like
what you're
one
doing.
One thing does build to another, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
So tell me how you develop that skill or that that ability, or is that just something that comes
I
with the package?
I have no idea. I have no idea at all. I just eat the food. And what? I like the food, so.
And you married into an American Indian family.
Correct.
And it sounds like you're pretty interested in Native culture even before you met your wife. I was looking at sort of this biographical work that you did where you have pictures from the American Indian movement all the way back. And so you had a fascination with indigenous people.
Yeah, I guess when I was little, I don't know that by then you would call it a fascination. I would call it a feeling, mm-hmm. I had a feeling. There was something, you know, I can go to the online ADN and look at the comments, and I see the most ignorant comments people write mm-hmm. about Native people. And they might think they're justified in these comments because there are indeed social problems. But there is something in any Native American community I have ever been in, there is a heart and there is a soul that simply does not exist anywhere else. And I love that. I mean, I love to feel it. I can't explain it much better than that. So
I guess I would say that there's a belonging or there's a sense of purpose and identity when you're in that subsistence lifestyle, which I don't think we have access to in the dominant culture where you just go to the store and buy something. There's a kind of a meaning to life that is very real in the Arctic when people are living that lifestyle. And maybe that explains a little bit of the despair people feel when the culture is damaged, is that the loss of that must be very intense and something that, you know, these ignorant people you're talking about, they don't have no idea what probably I'm talking about right now. Yeah?
Right. Right. So,
yeah. So, you were mentioning when you got this first picture of the whale being harpooned and what a great moment that was, and your camera fogged up. You must have learned over time some tips about how to take pictures in very cold weather and keep your equipment working.
Well, I'm always trying different things, and it's, you never, you know, anything can happen, and technology has changed a lot. And in all honesty, the new technology, if you get the right camera and you get the right battery, they're better than the old cameras were for cold weather. Mm-hmm. But you have to keep your battery charged, and that's the challenge. And what I do is I keep a battery for, I'll have two cameras with me, mm-hmm. and I'll keep an extra battery for each one under my parka sleeve when the weather's cold. And then
so you just keep it like strapped to your arm or something? Or just stuff it in there?
Yeah, I just stuff it in there.
Uh-huh.
And that keeps it relatively warm. And when the other battery dies, then I switch it out and put that battery in. And that's really about the only special trick I have. Mm-hmm. But of course you do learn things like, okay, if you're on the ice whaling, you want to have a different camera out of the tent than you have in the tent, because when you take your camera from outside in, it will instantly ice up and fog up.
Right.
And things as far as like that happened on that thing, you just have to be careful not to breathe on your viewfinder, you know, when it's cold.
Yeah. So do these modern cameras, do they, it used to be an issue with photojournalists working in the cold in Alaska is that the shutter would actually freeze sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Is that still an issue?
I haven't had that happen in a long time. I think a modern camera will stop shooting before the shutter does that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've used my Canon D series in 45 below, and they have kept going for me. Now the
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Now the lesser ones won't. They might last half an hour. They might, if you're lucky, you might get an hour out of them. But like the Canon 1DX, which I have now, that'll shoot for a long time in very cold weather.
Uh-huh.
So, but what you can do is you can lose your information, your LCD and all that. That can freeze up and just stop working for you.
So, in the old days, I mean, we were shooting with film. You had to make a lot of guesstimates with your f-stop and stuff, because if you use the through-the-lens viewfinder, you just end up with white pictures from the snow. Now with digital, if your viewfinder's working, you could just play with it until you get what you want, right?
Yeah, pretty much. It is, because you can see what you're doing right away. And also with film, a couple of problems that sometimes your film would break when you advance it. It would be so cold and brittle, it would just break.
Right.
When cold air is dry air, because cold air cannot hold moisture. So you have static electricity, and you can develop your film, and there's lightning streaks going across it. Mm-hmm. And that's the little bursts of static electricity that happen when you advance your film. So you had to learn to advance your film slowly if you could. Now, if something's happening real fast, and you couldn't advance it slowly with a motor, only with my used Canon F1s, and those were manual all the way. Mm-hmm. So that was a trick if you're using film and it's very cold. You advance the film slowly.
And it must be torture when you come back with, you've waited 3 years for the perfect picture, you come back with it and it's got some technical flaw that kills you, right?
Right. And I think every photographer experiences that.
That's why it's such a tough job. Mm-hmm. The Outdoor Explorer, my name is Charles Wolforth. I'm talking to Bill Hess, who is a photographer and has spent decades documenting indigenous culture and outdoors stuff in Alaska. You actually crashed your plane at one point.
I did.
And you walked away.
I did.
And that was the end of your aviation career.
So far, but I hope not.
Is it a financial thing that you, after the expense, you just couldn't find a plane you could afford?
Yep, and I couldn't put mine back together again.
Mm-hmm.
So it looked like it could be put back together, but when I got an estimate on it, the repair bill was $45,000. I'd only paid $15,000 for it, so, you know.
Yeah. So the career, your career goes up and down with the different opportunities you have.
Oh yeah. I still expect to go broke a few times yet in my life, and maybe pretty soon. Who knows? So.
But you've also gotten some good recognition for your work. You know, your book was very well received. I think people really respected what you did. And it kind of puts you a little bit in the position of representing these people you're photographing, as that you've taken these pictures, you're describing their culture for other people. I'm wondering, that put you, do you feel kind of responsible when you're doing that? Do you feel nervous about representing a culture that you're not actually a part of?
Well, I do. I mean, I really felt nervous with Gift of the Will, but the reception was so good. But one thing I would say that makes a difference too is that I, like you say, I'm doing this for the world, but I do it first for the people.
Mm-hmm.
First, I do it for the people, and only a small part of what I do actually makes it beyond out into the world. So
do you edit photos and say, well, I don't want to use this one, even though it's a good picture, because some animal rights person might not like it, or take that kind of attitude?
Well, I've done fair amount of that. Mm-hmm. Although what I notice on Facebook is that the people themselves, when they go out and they show their own life too, and
much more now than used to. Yeah.
Oh yes, much more. And I see them put up photos that I would have been hesitant to have put up in the past myself. So, you know.
In terms of pictures of animal parts.
Of blood and all that. And so, you know, it's part of the life. It's nothing to be ashamed of. They have earned the right to do that. They have survived by doing it. And it's just nothing to be ashamed of. There may be people who get upset and refuse to understand, and by refuse, I mean refuse. They just will not understand. But that doesn't mean you hide your way of life. And so, yeah, there's some things I will hold back, but I'm not afraid to show blood.
Yeah. I think more people understand it now than used to. Don't you think? I mean, people have sort of become a little bit more accepting of hunting in general in the wider culture, and sort of recognition that we, you know, most of us are mediators anyway, so let's not be hypocrites about it.
Yeah, I think there is, but I think there remains a lot of people who still just simply, they don't believe anyone. Some people don't believe anyone should ever kill an animal, period, of course. Mm-hmm. Some people believe it's okay to eat their beef and their chicken, but no one should kill a wild animal. Some people think it's okay to eat their beef, chicken, and venison, but by gum, you had better not kill a whale. Mm-hmm. And so you deal with that. And then there are people, and you see this again and again, they say, well, this can't be subsistence. They're using a motorboat. They're using snow machines. And that is just, you know, it's just beyond my imagination how they can think like that. That's like saying the farmer out there ought to still be using just a digging stick, you know.
Right. It's all cultural. You know, North Slope people told me a very funny story when they went to an International Whaling Commission meeting in Japan. They went into a restaurant where whale was served, and the people running the restaurant were very nervous about it. And they said, hey, don't worry. We eat whale, too, in Alaska. We understand whale as food. And so they struck it up with these Japanese people and were having a good conversation. And they said, hey, we also eat reindeer in Alaska. The Japanese were horrified. What? That's disgusting. You can't do that.
Oh, my.
It's, everybody has these different prejudices about food. Did you, when you wrote your stuff, did you pass it by elders? Did you check it out with them before you published it? Or did you feel like you knew it well enough you didn't need to do that?
I generally always had someone that knew the culture go over things with me before
Just make sure you didn't make mistakes.
Yeah, and especially, nobody ever really made me change or told me to change anything, pretty much. The only time that happened was when I did a big essay on the Barrow Whaler football team, and some people thought I put too many pictures of football in that were above me, and they had me cut my Barrow Whaler football essay down. But okay. That's really the only time. Uh-huh. But I need help with names. To this day, I need help with names. And so I always do things like that.
Yeah. So tell us about the work you're doing now. What's what you're doing that's exciting in terms of your photography career and your journalism?
Well, my career has went many ways. I did my Wunyuk magazines for a while, and then I left that for a while and just managed to do other things all over the state. And then, there's so much happening and changing in the Arctic right now that I really feel that I need to show what's happening today, and I need to show it in the context of how I knew it before. And so,
speaking of the climate or cultural things?
Climate. The climate has changed so much. So much. And so I recently published, you know, I've got a, I don't publish a Wunyuk on a regular basis like I used to, but I do get special issues from time to time. I did one not too long ago on the Cross Island Whale Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
I spent this spring, or at least part of this spring, in Point Hope and got really an excellent essay going there, although I don't have any funding to do anything with it yet, but I believe I will have some soon. And there's a big celebration that they have that reaches back to antiquity. It disappeared for a while, but they started it up in modern fashion in 1988 called Kivyak. Mm-hmm. And that started in 88, and they've done it on the average of every other year since. And I have photographed every Kivyak except for one.
Is that right?
That's right. So I am.
And we should tell people what Kivyak is. This is a in the old days, there were interior in Eskimo villages and coastal villages, and they would get together on a regular basis for sort of a potlatch type thing where it was a dancing and celebrating, and they would give gifts to each other, and that's how they did their trade between the coast and the ocean, because the ocean people needed caribou and the interior people needed whale fat, and that so they would have a dancing celebration that trade would take place. And then it died out when the interior villages died out, and it's been revived.
Well, yeah, that happened, and they had big trade gatherings like that. But Kivyak could be just pure Inupiaq too, or mm-hmm. it could be one village has a really good year, or a good couple of years. They build up an excess of food and furs and what have
right.
you. So they send a runner to another village mm-hmm. to invite them, or another group. Maybe they're moving around, but they're out there, and they know how to reach each other.
Mm-hmm.
So they send that runner, and then they have a race. They come in. It could be just two villages. It might be more.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just there's a lot of gift-giving. There's a lot of dancing, feasting, and they revived that in 1988. And they've had people from all over in that time, from Greenland, Canada, Russia, Polynesian people from the islands come.
And they still do the running.
Yeah, but it's a symbolic run now.
Right.
It's a symbolic run. They run from airport into the high school,
uh-huh.
which is not very far. But if it's 40 below like it has been at times... That's far enough.
Yeah, really. And so, you're out there taking pictures of it. Well, Bill, this has been really, really, really fun. And if folks want to learn more about Bill Hess's work, go to alaskapublic.org. There's a link there to today's show, and we're going to put his work up and ways you can find out about getting his book, Gift of the Whale, and some of his other work. Good luck with all your endeavors. I'm really, really honored to have had you on the show, Bill.
Well, I'm honored to be here, Charles.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
So that's it for today's Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey. Grace Bogine is our production assistant. My name is Charles Wolforth. Thanks for being with us. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.